Oborne and Heller on Cricket, brought to you by the Chiswick Calendar.
Hello, it's Peter Oborne in Nablus, where, believe it or not, I'm studying or learning Arabic at the university. It's an excellent course.
Hello, it's Richard Heller in southeast London. Perhaps I should say Ahlan wa Sahlan. Not that I know any more Arabic. I'm in southeast London. It's quite a sunny day here, but I'm sure not as sunny as Nablus. And it's a real thrill again. We say this every year, but it always is, to welcome Lawrence Booth, the editor of Wisdom. And Lawrence, this is getting absolutely monotonous, but once again, it's an enthralling edition of Wisdom, and it's packed with lots of big issues outside of cricket, which shape cricket. Well, politics, the environment, class, race, all manner of really deep issues, and we look forward to discussing them with you.
Thanks for having me on, Richard. I'm not learning Arabic, so I can't offer that. But long may the monotony continue. It's been another fun edition of Wisdom to do. There's always plenty to talk about in cricket, so let's do it.
Well, Lawrence, I'd like to go in first on your notes to the editor, which are always very stimulating. You pay tribute at the very beginning to an absolutely phenomenal Test and white ball England team, especially for playing Test cricket in a new way. I was intrigued to read that Ben Stokes is now the most successful Test captain in English history, or in anybody's history, measured by the win rate of those who did more than 10 Tests.
Yeah, I think he actually equaled Lindsay Hassett, the Australian captain who replaced Don Bradman. In fact, so the first 12 Tests, both Hassett and Stokes won 10. I think Hassett drew the other two, actually, so he's probably just fractionally ahead of Stokes, who lost the other two, one of them by one run after enforcing the follow-on against New Zealand. He should really have 11 out of 11 wins there. But no, it's been an astonishing turnaround by England, led by Stokes. They'd won 1 out of 17 under Joe Root, who then quit, which I think was the right decision. And Stokes, and with the help of Brendan McCullum, the head coach, have turned around the Test team. They've got them scoring at 4.76 and over in that time, which is astonishing, really, the kind of rate that used to win you one-day matches. And they've got people talking about Test cricket again. There's been the word Bazball keeps getting bandied about. The England team don't like it, but it's good that there's a nickname for a Test approach, because it means that, you know, the man and woman on the street are talking about Test cricket, which is precisely what Test cricket needs right now.
They're talking about Test cricket, but unfortunately they're not seeing it, are they, on free-to-air television?
Yeah, I mean, that is a subject that we have touched on in the notes down the last few years. We didn't this time round, perhaps because you have to sort of change it up a bit, but my view on that remains the same, which is that it was a questionable decision to go behind the paywall. Sky Money has brought a lot of benefits to English cricket, there is no doubt about that. But the fact that the ECB decided, for example, to make part of the 100 free to air was an indication of what they really thought about that. Sort of, you know, Tom Harrison, the former chief exec, said he didn't want cricket to be the richest but most invisible sport. And that is still an issue, certainly, for cricket. Had Bazball happened with Test cricket on terrestrial TV, I think we'd have had even more of an impact. And we have an Ashes this summer, where we just hope that it kind of reaches out beyond its sort of paywall constituency. We know what happened in 05. We know what the Ashes can do, how it can ignite the nation and get the average sports fan involved. So the hope is that despite its presence behind a paywall, it can still make an impact this summer.
I must say the Ashes series this summer is absolutely mouthwatering. I mean, you're describing what Stokes has done to the English cricket team. It's unbelievable. And this is arguably the greatest English Test cricket team of all time. And they've reinvented the sport.
I think though your last point about the reinvention is the key. I mean, man for man, you could probably pick better England teams from the past. But what he's done is that he's essentially used the same players that were struggling under Root and turned them into, he sort of flicked a switch. It's a change in mindset. And he's, Brendan McCullum and Ben Stokes have somehow encouraged the players to lose their fear of getting out, which is quite a feat really in cricket. So the holy grail really of cricketing psychology. So I think what he has done, the transformation, the way he's changed the perception of Test cricket is remarkable. It's probably not the best England team ever, but that kind of doesn't matter. And yeah, as you say, the Ashes, the prospect there is mouthwatering. Stokes has already asked for fast, flat pitches, which is interesting because Australia haven't won in England since 2001, mainly because they can't handle the moving ball, either off the pitch or through the air. Now, the old school of thought says that let's just keep beating them as England have always beaten them on, you know, lively tracks. Well, Stokes doesn't want any of that. He's sending a message to his team saying, we want flat tracks, we want to score at 5-6 and over. We want to bully them into submission. Australia have got a great seam attack, haven't they? So that could be interesting. They may enjoy those conditions as well, and the Australian batsmen may enjoy fast, flat pitches too. So we're set up for a humdinger, I would say. I'd probably fancy England, but anything can happen with this side, as we saw in Wellington.
Indeed. Just before we leave, Basmore, I think it'd be remarkable. Brendan McCullum could be one of the historic figures in world cricket. I mean, he launched, you know, the IPL with that wonderful innings in its first year, and now he's kind of breathing the kiss of life into Test cricket.
Yeah, he is an astonishing man. I mean, there is an argument for saying he is the most significant cricketer of the last 20 years. He, you know, I was there that night in Bangalore, actually, when he scored 158 not out off about 70 balls, a ridiculous innings, to get the IPL going. And T20 cricket had been around for 5 years at that point, don't forget, in county cricket. Well, of course, the moment McCullum gave the IPL a sensational kick up the backside on the first night, it became an Indian format, really. So he did that. And then it was interesting when he got the test job. Many of us were expecting him to get the white ball job instead, but he wanted a new challenge. He'd never coached a red ball team, let alone a test team. It was a gamble, but Rob Key, the managing director, knew what he wanted, and he knew England had to take a risk to turn things round. And McCullum is an inveterate risk taker, so is Stokes, by the way. So they gel very nicely, and I take my hat off to him. You know, the Ashes will be a big test. Five tests in India in January, February will be an even bigger test. So these things can unravel, but let's not get too far ahead of ourselves. They won 1 out of 17, now 10 out of 12, and everyone's talking about them. Take my hats off.
I remember, I mean, just to drive the achievement, I do remember Silverwood saying, he's the predecessor to McCullum, that there's nothing else you can do with this lot, you know. And of course, McCullum turns up and Stokes, who's obviously one of the great leaders of the history of cricket. I mean, it's very hard to think of anybody else like him, perhaps a few Australians, and transforms it so dramatically.
Yeah, that's right. England looked a bit helpless and hopeless towards the end of Silverwood's reign. I mean, that 4-0 series in Australia, the defeat there was out there, and it was a pretty depressing series to cover because Root and Silverwood just kept saying the same thing again and again, which is, we know we've got the team to compete, and there's no evidence really to back that up. And then, of course, they dropped Broad and Anderson and went to the Caribbean and lost 1-0 there, and that was really the end of Root. Silverwood had already gone by that stage. Root had a chance to save his captaincy. In retrospect, it was probably a good thing that England lost there because it allowed them to make this fresh start with Stokes, who has turned things round simply by saying, I give you permission to hit out and get out, and that will not be held against you. And that is a radical change in thinking.
Well, it's liberated Root for a start. It's obviously, yeah. The captaincy was obviously a burden to him. You know, it's able to express itself. So I loved the story in your notes about Stokes consoling with a text, the teenage spinner whom he hit for 34 in an over.
That shows
great empathy.
Yeah, I just picked that out as a sort of paragraph for the notes, really. He'd hit Worcestershire's spinner, Josh Baker, teenage spinner, for 34, 5 sixes, and the last ball, a 1-bounce 4. He almost did the 36 in the over. And Stokes is, I think he's learnt a lot through the years, but through his own experiences about making mistakes, almost going to prison. He took time off to look after his mental health. His father died on the other side of the world. It was a traumatic experience for Stokes. And I think that's given him a degree of empathy that you wouldn't necessarily associate with him. You think of him as a sort of hard man of cricket. But he texted Josh Baker after that game and just said, I hope you're okay. Don't let this dispirit you too much. And I thought that was a good insight into the man management skills that he's brought to the England dressing room. He puts an arm around the guys he thinks are struggling. You know, take Jack Leach, for example, the spinner. You know, he's been managed brilliantly by Stokes, gives him the new ball, and he takes 10 wickets against New Zealand at Headingley, where only seamers are supposed to thrive. So everything Stokes has done really has turned to gold from a man management perspective, and the players will do anything for him. You know, Root was a lovely guy, well-liked, but didn't have the same presence or aura or charisma. Stokes has brought that to the team with astonishing consequences, really.
In defence of Root, I can't think of any other Test captains who've had that charisma, which Stokes was really a Homeric figure. He's like Achilles, or, you know, he's a hero built on Greek lines. But one criticism I'd have, why did he go to the IPL? He was suffering from an injury. And when you got the Ashes series ahead, what on earth was he doing going to the IPL?
Yeah, fair question. I think he was getting a lot of money, is the short answer. He was determined to look after his dodgy knee, so he was never going to bowl much at the IPL. He was sort of going out there as a not quite a specialist batter, because he has bowled a little bit. But you know, his thinking is, I think, you know, one of the concerns, his knee is a massive concern. We don't know how much longer he's going to be able to play Test cricket for. That's the sort of elephant in the room with this Test team at the moment. And he thinks he needs to cash in while he still can. It's a problem that players all around the world face now, national boards face. I mean, I'm sure we'll touch on this at some point. But the T20 Leviathan is forcing players into making these kinds of decisions. The national boards would rather they didn't. But they are monitoring Stokes, and he's not stupid. He's not going to bowl himself into the ground for Chennai Super Kings because he wants to be there for the Ashes. He wants to be part of history. So we have to trust him to a degree.
Have to, but that does indeed take us on to a big theme in this year's almanac. The threat to bilateral Test cricket, apart from Tests between England and Australia and India, and the way that T20 leagues are just hoovering up all the world's best players, and sort of they've taken some out of the picture completely of Test cricket. You know, is there any way to stop this? I'd like to quote one really, I think, particularly powerful sentence in your notes, which goes to the heart of it. Now, three power blocks are in a relationship that is part symbiotic, part parasitic. The T20 franchises are in it for themselves, the ICC nominally in charge, and the national boards clean to placate broadcasters and generate their own revenue. It seems to me that most of the cricket actually reported in this year's almanac is cricket that's confected for the marketplace. It's cricket that's designed to create a television audience, to create remuneration for players and franchises, and cricket lovers worldwide are simply consumers of a product that's been marketed for them, and the only power they have is in the marketplace to watch it or to not watch it. Sorry, that's long preliminary to a question, but do you see any way through this relationship? Is there any way to get cricket more deeply responsive to cricket lovers than just as passive consumers?
I think of it a bit like climate change, in as much as there's no going back in some tipping points have happened, but we might be able to mitigate the worst of it if we act now. And that might involve, for example, national boards saying we're not going to release players for any more new tournaments. For example, Saudi Arabia have suddenly shown an interest in hosting their own T20 tournament. And they want to make that as big as the IPL. There was even talk of them getting Indian players involved, which would be a game changer. So the boards have to say, right, enough is enough. We've spoken a good game down the years about protecting Test cricket and the importance of international cricket. Well, that's not been backed up by their deeds. It never has. I mean, I've banged on about this in Wisden ever since I got the job, and I've done my 12th almanac now. And so the reason I sort of went big on this in the notes after the positive stuff about Bazball was that in January we had five different T20 franchise competitions going on around the world, and it was probably great for the local fans, although one of them, the International League T20 in the UAE, was watched by no one. It was a purely for TV tournament, as you say, the idea of spectators as consumers was sort of underwrote that competition. So it became unfollowable. Players were jumping around between competitions. The idea of loyalty to a team has absolutely vanished. Agents are making a packet. My only question, I accept the importance of T20 in the ecosystem. I just think it's gone too far, and the influx of private money. We can't put that particular genie back in the bottle. The question is, how can we mitigate things? Well, the thing I said at the top of this answer, that the national boards grow a spine. Also, they start paying the players a bit more. Now, that would involve a bit more sharing of the pie at ICC level between the full members. And that, again, I'm probably in the realms of naivety and idealism here, because it would mean India having to say, all right, we won't take 37%, which is what they're pushing for at the moment. They currently have about 22% of the pie. They want much more than that. They argue that they generate between 75 and 80% of the global revenues on cricket. So why shouldn't they get all this extra money? Well, you can see the capitalist argument for that, fine, but the consequences of that will be that the smaller countries will wither on the vine, and then international cricket becomes pretty boring, actually. It'll be England v Australia v India in these marquee test series, World Cups, and T20 franchise cricket. We'll go down the football route, essentially. So we just have, someone has to stand up. I have hopes for the new ECB guys, Richard Thompson, Richard Gould. They've said that money isn't everything, so that's something. That's more than their predecessors were saying. But we need more people to say that, and crucially, we need India on board to say that it's not all about exploiting the consumers and making as much money as possible for a handful of businessmen and the top players. I'm afraid I'm pessimistic about it. I know people always want a solution. There isn't an easy one.
I have to say that I was shocked to my marrow by the Spirit of Cricket lecture, which was a celebration of franchise cricket. Now, I have to say, I thought that Andrew Strauss was better than that. And I did note that his next engagement was to sit next, go to a Tory party meeting in somewhere. We know what the Tory party's like now. It's all about greed. And Strauss was at that as well. What's gone wrong with Andrew Strauss?
Well, I think he was always a bit of a true blue, wasn't he? Let's be honest. I was at that lecture as well, and I came out of it thinking, I do confess he spoke compellingly. His enthusiasm was genuine, but let's be honest about what he was saying here. He was essentially saying that it was good that a lot of the players were now making more money. And to me, it seemed as if he was speaking very much from a player's perspective. And I don't begrudge the players more money. I'm not trying to shame them for their greed or anything like that. But it did seem a sort of narrow perspective to me, and it didn't take into account the implications for international cricket, bilateral series. Forget Test cricket. Bilateral white ball cricket is dying an inevitable death, I think. England went to Bangladesh recently and more or less sacrificed a T20 series to see if Sam Curran could bat at number 5 or 6 in the World Cup later in the year. They didn't replace 2 injured batsmen and they were happy to lose 3-0, really. They went to Australia after the World Cup and lost a one-day series 3-0. They didn't care. They were fulfilling an obligation. So we do have a big problem, and I'm not sure we have overall the administrators with the capacity or desire to change the direction we're heading in.
I'm certainly not sanguine about the ICC doing anything to resist this trend. I think that the ICC shows up very badly in 4 issues you've covered in quite some detail in the Almanac this year. Let's start with Afghanistan. In your notes, you mentioned that the ICC has made no contact with Tuba Sangha, wrote such a moving piece in last year's Almanac, or with Afghan women in exile in Australia. I've seen no apparent contact with any women in Afghanistan. There's no women in the ICC inquiry team into Afghanistan, and it's met a male or male Afghan cricket board appointed by the Taliban. Doesn't seem to have taken any notice of the worsening condition of women in Afghanistan or the persecution of minorities there. This is the ICC is, in my opinion anyway, has just shown itself incapable even of investigating a situation in Afghanistan, let alone making any decisions about it.
Yeah, I mean, their basic position is they don't get involved in the internal politics of member countries. Now, you know, they say that, I mean, one of their sort of, in their constitution is the governmental interference is punishable by exclusion, essentially, from the ICC. You know, Zimbabwe were kicked out of Test cricket for a while because of the financial issues there. What my suggestion in the notes is that the Afghanistan female cricketers who fled to Australia mainly, I mean, Tuba Sangha, you mentioned, was in Canada when I last spoke to her. But the majority of them went to Australia. And why not just set up, why not turn Australia into a home from home for the Afghanistan women cricketers? Allow for touring teams to visit them there. I mean, there's clearly no way they're going to be able to set up cricket back in Taliban-ruled Afghanistan. So make a virtue of this tragedy. Something good could come of this if the ICC backed that group of players, gave them something to, you know, something to cling on to amid this disastrous situation. But they're pretty, you know, the ICC have pretty good at washing their hands of big decisions on the whole. They have become an organisation that essentially organises World Cups, which makes them a lot of money. The full members, you know, they don't really make any important decisions about the governance of the game, really, because they are the sum of their parts, which are the full members, and that essentially means they do what India tells them. That's been a way for a long time. So the ICC are, you know, people say, why can't they do this and that? The honest answer is they are powerless. It's not what they do anymore. They just organise World Cups generally, point umpires and fine people for having the wrong sticker on their bat. You know, there's not a lot left for them to do.
Well, they could not. They had some power over Ukraine, and what they did over Ukraine is to penal. It seems to me, and you've covered it in some depth in the almanac, is to the ICC has actually punished Ukraine for being the victim of war and invasion, but it's absolutely taken no account of the war in its treatment of Russia.
Well, again, you know, it's their idea that politics and sport don't mix. I mean, look, they're basically the ICC meeting last summer where they discussed various memberships. Ukraine had been assured, it seems, that they would become an associate member. Now, this was before Russia invaded in late February 2022. Then, of course, the meeting takes place, and the ICC's argument is that there is no meaningful cricket taking place in Ukraine. Well, obviously not, because, you know, they've been invaded. And Russia were expelled, actually, but that was for reasons not to do with the war. That was because there are competing boards in Russia. It's all very complex, but
it's a very, very familiar situation in a lot of countries. Yeah,
that's right. So maladministration, essentially. The hope is, I mean, this piece, Alex Preston writes this piece about cricket in Ukraine, quite a moving piece, really. Mm. The hope is that once the war is over, that Ukraine will quickly be ushered into ICC membership. And I think that the rest of the world will be cheering them on.
Mm. And then, you know, what the ICC can and can't do, what the ICC doesn't have to do is do a sponsorship deal with Aramco, which is something I've also covered in some depth, and a very scathing piece by the winner of the new writing competition in Wisden.
That's right, a young chap, student from Melbourne, called Dan Crowley. He went to a lot of the T20 World Cup games at Melbourne and noticed that Aramco sponsorship was everywhere, all around the grounds. It was a huge, and anyone who doesn't know Aramco, this sort of the fossil fuel giants, mainly owned by the Saudi government, and by some calculations, they have contributed to 4% of greenhouse gas emissions since 1965. So they're a major polluter, whichever way you look at it. I challenged ICC on this at the time, wrote a column in Wisden Cricket Monthly about it, and their answers were fairly weak. I mean, they pointed out that they supply these bottle recycling machines at the grounds as if that was in any way going to offset the disastrous emissions that Aramco are responsible for. But actually, you know, the moment that the story broke earlier this year that Saudi Arabia were thinking of doing their own T20 tournament with the backing of the ICC, it suddenly started to make sense a bit. Hang on, the ICC trying to cozy up to the Saudis here. They've already got a foot, you know, in football and in golf. F1, clearly. Is cricket next to go that way? And of course, you know, Saudi's on the ICC's doorstep. ICC based in the UAE. It's not that far away. that really will be the game changer if Saudi Arabia get on board. They don't produce any cricketers of note themselves. They would simply be poaching cricketers from overseas for their own purposes. And you've got the IPL for six weeks to 2 months now. They want to expand that. If the Saudi tournament comes in, you'd expect that to be 3 or 4 weeks, huge money. What time of year would that take place? Which particular country's home summer would that ruin? And the ICC don't seem too fussed about that.
That takes us on to the environment, and you're now giving a regular slot every year to Tanya Aldred, we've had as a guest here on the podcast. Message this year is, though, a rather depressing one from her. She reports several very vivid local demonstrations and events, but it's really business as usual, isn't it, on the environment, from the ICC and from national cricket administrators. Cricket lovers worldwide are a very big, and in cricket lovers in every country are quite a big potential block of voters, especially on the Indian subcontinent. And I just wondered if you saw any way of mobilizing them, organizing them into a coherent political lobby to counteract the extraordinary extraordinarily strong vested interests that are taking over cricket and using it for sports washing to put a gloss on their own activities.
Well, I mean, you say Tanya's piece was sort of slightly discouraging. I mean, I take your point. I think there was also signs that people were starting to use cricket as a sort of the place where they could do their environmental activism, and there were several banners held up at Lord's last year, sort of accusations about, you know, people up at MCC and their involvement with companies that are involved with fossil fuel, the fossil fuel industry. And so that started to make an impact. So she focused on the activists, you know, Extinction Rebellion, these kinds of groups. It does seem that those groups are most active in the UK at the moment, in the cricket-playing nations. I mean, one of the ICC's arguments, one of the issues they claim they face, is that the question of climate change is not taken as seriously in some full members as it is in others. And I think the implication there is that India, for instance, aren't particularly fussed about doing their part right now. And that is a problem. And I think because uber capitalism has taken over Indian cricket, and the ruling BJP party kind of runs Indian cricket right now, and they don't have a lot of time for the sort of climate change argument, that we're banging our head against a brick wall to a degree. I mean, I spend a fair bit of time in India, and the main concern among fans are queuing for a ticket, not getting, sometimes, you know, the police manhandle them, they get struck by lathis, you know, these big sticks, and they want to get a ticket and get in and watch the game and go home. It's, you know, the idea of activism for an issue that they think is decades down the road is sort of far from their minds. And I do understand that. But what it needs is more people the activists in the UK that Tanya writes about to spread the word around the world. Otherwise, it's pretty hopeless.
Does that? I mean, in the Indian subcontinent, cricket is more vulnerable to extreme weather than anywhere else. There are places where it will could quite easily become unplayable. In not just in decades, but in a short time.
Yeah, absolutely. At the Wisden Dinner recently, our speaker was Peter Frankopan, the sort of Oxford professor who's written this incredible book about basically the sort of natural history of the world, how climate changes has affected the world. And he warned that at some point in the near future, all Test cricket will have to be day-night Test cricket, because it'll simply be too hot to play it in daytime hours. And that particularly applies to India. I was there recently, and about 3 days after we left, the whole of India was 40 degrees. that is frightening. At what point will someone, you know, pass out from heat stroke in the middle of a test match? And what will the authorities do about it? So this is something they've got to take seriously.
Obviously, this issue of it isn't just affecting cricket. I mean, how does that... Is football, for instance, which is a much bigger sport than cricket, is that, how is that doing by contrast?
Well, we just had a World Cup in Qatar, didn't we? Where there's where money spoke more than anything. So I don't think sports in general are doing much about it. They don't see it as their argument is we can't solve climate change, as if anyone's asking them to. I mean, all anyone is asking them to do is to sort of tend to their patch, set an example. You know, clubs are waking up to it, but cricket's a long way behind. ICC have been hopeless on this. Tanya asks them for comment every year, and they keep sort of kicking the can down the road and saying, yeah, we're getting a sort of a PowerPoint presentation together and we're going to discuss it at the next meeting. It never really happens. So we need activists. We need people like Tanya to keep writing, to keep on the ICC's case, because, as you know, as Richard said, the cricket will be greatly affected by this. All the cricket nations are in vulnerable positions. Even in the UK, we get a heavier summer rain, which would disrupt things in ways that we haven't sort of previously experienced. So football's not great. Cricket's even worse, I would say.
Before we leave this, one suggestion for next year, Lawrence. Make the weather section, Andrea Higgle's weather section, a worldwide one. Report worldwide weather and possibly add a map showing all the places where a major match was played in temperatures of, let's say, 35 and above.
It's a good idea. We'd have to send reporters out with a thermometer.
Yes.
Which might be, you know, but why not? I mean, that's the kind of direction we're going in. I mean, that may well work for Tanya's piece. I will make a note. Thank you.
But moving on from that, I mean, Wisdom continues to cover more and more wicket cricket, don't you? 90 pages this year. Is that enough?
I don't know. I think it's a reflection of, well, put it this way, it's more than used to be. And we are taking women's, we're obliged, and it's the right thing to do to take women's cricket more seriously each year. We always talk about it. So, for example, next year, we have a kind of review piece, but Mel Farrell, the Australian journalist, often writes, and we decided that from next year, that piece should have, we should have country by country breakdowns rather than just sort of general theme. So that would take it more in line with the coverage of men's cricket. I mean, one of the issues we have is keeping Wisden within bounds. You know, this year was 1,616 pages, the longest since I've done it. And that's partly because women's cricket's growing. That's great. But we have to find ways of squeezing it all in. We will keep taking it seriously, obviously, because especially with the Women's Premier League in India starting this year, it has moved to another level quite quickly, which we applaud. So we do have to keep up, for sure.
You have to report cricket as it is played. So is it still the case that, you know, judging by the coverage and Wisden, that nine times more serious cricket is played by men than by women?
I couldn't tell you the actual figure, but that wouldn't surprise me. It maybe nine is a bit high. I mean, look, part of the issue is that women's domestic cricket, okay, forget the franchise tournaments are starting to grow up. Women's domestic cricket still hasn't really caught much of the imagination beyond some hardcore fans of women's cricket, I would say. But international cricket is growing exponentially. In franchise cricket now, with the success of the Women's 100, the Women's Premier League, the Women's Big Bash has always been a success in Australia. So those three tournaments in particular are demanding more time and attention. We just have to keep monitoring it and reflecting it as we feel it deserves.
I must say, it's Women's Premier League, I think, is going to be immense. And it already attracts what Women's 2020 is, a phenomenal TV audiences, doesn't it? I mean, like a billion for one of the matches, I was being told.
Right, yeah, something like that. And also crowds packing out Indian stadiums. Now, the BCCI felt for years that women's cricket wouldn't be as attractive as men's and never really invested in it. And it wasn't really until Pakistan started talking about doing their own women's tournament. That obviously got people interested in India. So we better get in there first. And they've cleverly called it the Women's Premier League, you'll notice, not the Women's Indian Premier League. They are staking a claim to this being the sort of predominant global women's tournament. And, you know, of course, the moment India backs something in cricket, it becomes huge. So it has changed the game for women's players who can suddenly earn, you know, $300,000 just from playing that tournament. This is money that even 5 years ago would have been undreamed of.
I'm unbelievable, given that, you know, basically the England test players were paying weren't they, until about 10 years ago, to play for England. There wasn't really any money. They just did it for love.
That's right.
And now suddenly you can make a very serious sum of money indeed as a top-class women's player.
That's right. It has changed everything. And they now face the question that men's cricket has faced. You know, will the BCCI, for example, allow their women's players to keep playing in overseas domestic competitions, because the men can't do that? So will India exercise responsibility with the immense power they have? That could be a key driver in the direction that women's cricket takes over the next few years. Because there are lots of good stories lower down the food chain in women's cricket. You know, Brazil have hit headlines. One of their players was playing in this fair break tournament in the UAE recently, took wickets. A seamer called Laura Cardoso, teenager. Rwanda are a good story. Thailand, you know, there are lots of great stories lower down the sort of hierarchy, and you just hope that India keeps backing them.
It's a nice reminder in the almanac from Ralph Nicholson that women were 2 years ahead of men in staging a World Cup. It's no criticism, but it's nice that World Cup gets some retrospective coverage now in the current wisdom, because it didn't get very much in wisdom at the time, did it?
No, so we ran it because it's this year is 50 years on from that World Cup in 1973, 2 years before the men's, as you say. And Wisden 1974 gave it three pages or something, which included all the short scores. But then, as Raf points out, a couple of years later, referred to the 1975 World Cup as the first cricket World Cup. So typically, the women's competition was almost ignored and forgotten. And she does make a point in that piece about how Lords had turned down a request to stage the last group game. It wasn't quite a final because it was all sort of round robin, but it was England-Australia, which the organisers expected to be the final. Lords said, no, we can't stage that. So Edgbaston staged instead. But Lords did say, after the success of the tournament, they did say, well, we'll have to get you back for a test match next summer. Well, that test has never taken place. Yeah. England's women are yet to play a test match at Lords, more than 50 years on from the sort of suggestion that they would. So still work to do. But it's a lovely retrospective and a reminder that, we've been sort of not taking women's cricket as seriously as we should for a long time.
Sounds like that's about to change.
Yeah.
Lawrence, innovation in this year's almanac, something to report, the Wisden Trophy, or the repurposing of the Wisden Trophy for the best test performance in the year. A very good choice of its first winner, Johnny Bairstow. Just wondered if next year you might have nominations for each country in the future. Well, it should help keep a focus on test cricket, particularly in the countries where it's under challenge.
Yeah, that could be possible. And I think our Wisden.com, who a separate editorial team from us, but they ran what they regarded as the likely shortlist, which wasn't a formal shortlist by any means. But they sort of did the runners and riders in advance, who they thought it could be. The idea was, as some of the listeners probably know, the old Wisden Trophy was awarded to the winner of the England West Indies Test Series between 1963 and 2020. The ECB and the West Indies Cricket Board then decided to replace it with the Richards Botham Trophy, leaving the Wisden Trophy to gather dust, essentially. So with the help of MCC, we commissioned a new trophy because we feel Test cricket needs all the help it can get. And Bairstow, for his 200s at Edgbaston against India, was the first winner. But look, that we're always looking for more ways to get this kind of debate going. I mean, we awarded winners retrospectively from the first test in 1877 through to the Second World War, and next year's Wisden will do post-war winners retrospectively, if you like. So we're trying to kind of get that discussion going. But perhaps running a per country list is one way of... there's one way of attracting attention in advance of the announcement. So again, I shall take a note.
Who else was on the shortlist? Who was up against Bairstow?
I think the one that we were most tempted by was Ravindra Jadeja, who scored 175 and took 9 wickets in a test. I think it was against Bangladesh. It's a pretty sensational all-round performance. The problem, I think, was the quality of the opposition, which we do have to take into account a bit. And Bairstow obviously did it against a strong Indian attack, and England chased 378, which was their highest ever fourth innings chase. And they did it easily by, you know, loss of only three wickets. In fact, Bairstow featured heavily in the shortlist because there was a period where he scored 400s in five innings, and the other innings was a 70 not out, and he scored all of them at better than a run a ball. And so he could have chosen any of his performances, really, but the fact he got 200s in one test got him over the line. It's good fun. It's a good, you know, it's a sort of high-class Barham debate, isn't it, really? We want more people to join in next year.
Yeah. One historic note, if I may, on the past winners. Johnny Briggs won it, hypothetically, in 1889 for his 15 wickets for 28 in a single day versus South Africa. Just to note that that's a very dubious test match. It was a test match that was made retrospectively, and it wasn't designated as such until Wisden in 1924 by F.F. Ashley Cooper, the great reclusive statistician. So it's 35 years after the event. And I can't resist saying once again that that is the test match that included the legendary J.E.P. McMaster, England test player number 66, the number now used by Joe Root. And he was out first ball. He didn't bowl. He didn't take a catch. That represented his entire first-class career. A man after our own hearts.
We should have mentioned that in the little sort of notice to Briggs. But yeah, I mean, the fact is that it did get retrospectively, or it is now officially considered a test match. So we had to consider it. But yeah. I take your point.
It is. I don't know if you one might inaugurate a McMaster trophy for players who made the least distinguished contribution to Test cricket or to cricket at any level.
Might not make a note of that one.
seems a bit mean. Walk us through. It's such an interesting discussion. The five cricketers of the year.
Yes. Well, as probably people are tired of hearing two main criteria. You can't have been chosen before, and the emphasis is on the English summer. So, of course, that immediately takes out some of the, you know, perhaps the big names that you might expect to see on any kind of an ICC awards list, the Stokes or Root or Kohli or whatever. But it allows a bit of quirkiness, a bit of charm, and players who might not otherwise get recognised. I mean, this year we had a couple of New Zealanders, Tom Blundell, and Daryl Mitchell, who kept putting on about 200 in every test against England last summer, even though New Zealand lost 3-0, wasn't their fault. Ben Foulkes, England wicketkeeper, played a couple of crucial innings and averaged 70 for Surrey, who won the county championship. Harmanpreet Kaur, India's women captain, who led them to the first ODI series win in England since 1999 and scored a blistering 143 not out of 111 balls in the game at Canterbury. And then Matthew Potts, who made a pretty impactful Test debut for England, 4 for 13 against New Zealand, got Kane Williamson out twice. 20 wickets in the first five tests and 78 wickets across the summer, which was way more than any other bowler in the country. And six hauls of six or more, would you believe, which was the most since Wacker Yunus in 1991 in the championship. So five worthy winners, and perhaps people who wouldn't necessarily have been acknowledged had we simply gone for the five leading run scorers or the five leading wicket takers. I think that's one of the nice things about the Wisden Award.
That Potts is quite unimpressive. I mean, he's a bit of a sort of up and down bowler, isn't he? He doesn't come in like a Fred Truman or something like that, does he?
Well, you're right. He came to the Wisden dinner, and I was standing next to him. I'm not very tall. I'm about 5'9". He wasn't towering over me as you'd expect a fast bowler to do, but he's got presence. I think he's got more presence than he's credited for. He got Williamson out three times, Virat Kohli once. He bowls sort of slightly back of a length. He's accurate. He runs in hard. The game where he took the basically how he got in the England team was he played for Durham with Stokes in the team when Potts was sick. He wasn't feeling very well, but he went out there and he took seven wickets against Glamorgan and bowled them to victory while feeling pretty groggy. And Stokes decided that this guy was made of the right stuff and he wanted him in his dressing room. So he impressed the right man at the right time. And he's started this season well. He's sort of, every time I log on, he seems to be on a hat trick. He's sort of bowling people, sending stumps flying. So he will be in the fast bowling group that England will need to get through five tests in 6.5 weeks against Australia this summer, because they will be rested and rotated, and Potts is in that group now.
He's, just for the record, Harold Larwood was not a tall man either, was he?
No, that's right. 5'9", I think.
5 foot. I think it might even have been less, but doesn't stop you bowling very, doesn't stop you bowling fast and accurately and in a very hostile way.
That's right.
In fact, most notorious, even though he was quite small man, he bounced it as if he was Joel Garner or someone like that.
Yeah, it's pace. I mean, look at Mark Wood, who again isn't the tallest fast bowler, but he's quick. And if you've got a bouncer that's at 95 miles an hour, batsmen are going to be very wary about getting on the front foot. I mean, he's had an impact at the IPL, Wood. So pace is everything, really.
Hmm. Going back to your notes, Lawrence, very a good story, a hopeful story, is that of the success of the African Caribbean engagement program by Ebony Rainford Brent in the inner cities. And it sort of confirmed that there's still a great appetite to play cricket among young Afro Caribbean people, and that they're not sort of permanently lost to football. You know, this is often said in a rather lazy way by analysts and whatever, but it still shows that there's a big barriers of class and income in participation in cricket, aren't there? And, this is still something which cricket in every country, I think, has to address, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, Ebony, a lot of the focus of her work, which is amazing, by the way, has been on the racial side of things, and that's sort of inevitable given what's happened in English cricket the last few years, the Azim Rafiq scandal, and the way that non-white cricketers have felt able now to speak up about their experiences. Well, Ebony, instead of sort of just wringing her hands, has gone out and done something about it, and found not only that there is an appetite among the African Caribbean community in South London to play cricket and not just football, which is how they were being ignored essentially by the white mainstream, but that the working class white cricketers, there's a market there too, and that they've not felt, they felt as excluded as young black players. So she has been quite clear about that. It's race and it's class, and what she's done is revolutionary, really, and I think it shines a light, and not a very complimentary light, on what the ECB have done or haven't done, really. Within a couple of years, she has got 44 players from her ACE programme on county pathways. That's an amazing achievement. Now, these are people who'd have been lost to the game previously because apparently they preferred football. So, I absolutely doff my cap to her. What she's done is remarkable. And it's amid all the doom and gloom about racism in cricket, that is a positive story to come from it. She has driven that herself.
It's also replacing the Haringey Cricket Academy, which was disastrously closed with such horrible effects for young black cricketers 25 years ago.
Yeah, that's right, and that, you know, the stories coming out about why that was closed down, not very edifying, really, and it sounded like out and out racism, really. So she has revived that demographic. You know, a lot of the concern about non-white cricket in this country for the last 10 years has been about the Asian community, and again, rightly so, because they were being marginalised too. But I think the Anglo-Caribbean community has been totally forgotten, and what Ebony has done has shown that we forget them at that, our peril. It's not just about allowing more people to play cricket. It's about for the good of English cricket. We want these kids to come through. Do you remember, 20 years ago, we'd have England's test attack would be, there might be Gladstone Small or Devon Malcolm or Phil de Freitas or Chris Lewis. We sort of took it for granted.
Or Norman Cowan.
Norman Cowan, yes. Yeah, that's right. I mean, someone from Caribbean heritage would be taking the new ball for England. We sort of took it for granted, and then we forgot about that community. So that is changing, thankfully.
Now, Lawrence, we've had the outcome of the case against Michael Vaughan, more or less a verdict of not proven in Scottish terms. It doesn't seem to have been very satisfactory for anybody concerned. And it suggests that the hasn't satisfied either his accusers or his defenders. And it suggests really that the machinery still isn't there to investigate past, racist incidents. We've still got deep divisions, obviously, in Yorkshire cricket. We've still got cases pending, haven't we, about others who are accused. And the ECB still seems to be struggling to get a grip on this issue. Have you had any report of its independent commission on equity seems to be getting delayed all the time. Have you got any intimation of when we can expect that and when we can expect any results from it?
Well, weirdly not. I was having this discussion with Mike Atherton, I saw in the Lords press box last week at a county game, and we were wondering why it had been delayed, because the suggestion had been it would be late last year. They then said that they had so much evidence to consider that they sort of had to delay it for a bit. But Atherton's understanding was that all the evidence had been collected. So we're not quite sure what the delay is right now. To your point about the English cricket not being sort of well, I suppose, resourced or in a position to look at, investigate these historical claims, I mean, it is difficult, let's be honest. I mean, the case against Vaughan hinged on a comment he was alleged to have made on the outfield in a game in 2009. A couple of guys said he said what he was alleged to have said, he denied it, and someone else said he didn't say it. So that is tricky by any, you know, if that was heard in a court of law, it'd be extremely difficult to prove one way or the other. But don't forget that other players were sort of guilty as charged, I suppose, according to the Cricket Discipline Commission, former Yorkshire players. So, you know, that some of Rafiq's claims were backed up there. I think English cricket is still, when the results do eventually come out from the ICEC report, there will be a fresh reckoning to be had. It won't be pleasant, and English cricket will have to take it on the chin for a while, actually, and make the point that we start again. We cannot go back to what we've had before. This is the low point, and we start from now. So I think that's what will happen when this comes out. But I dare say there will be more unpleasantness to emerge.
Lawrence, I'd say that I think we're living through a golden age of cricket writing. Well, I was personally delighted to see Nicholas Brooks be the Wisdom Cricket Book of the Year award winner for that wonderful book he's done on Sri Lankan cricket. But there's so much else coming out at the moment, and Wisdom is really part of that. The way you've sort of broadened your coverage, you've not been afraid to go into the really delicate and tricky issues. So it's a magnificent addition, which has actually become a leading commentary, not just on cricket, but, you know, it's on cricket in that CLR James sense of which goes beyond the boundary and it examines the meaning of cricket in society and the world.
Well, that's kind of you to say so. Thank you. I mean, I've always tried to bear the CLR James sort of maxim in mind, and the idea that we're a social history as much as a cricket history. Benny Green, who anthologized almanacs years back, the jazz saxophonist, he always said that Wisdom was a social history of England, and you needed to be able to pick up any edition and you could find out what was going on in the country, broadly speaking, at the time. So I think sport's always more interesting when you sort of take it out of its immediate context. I mean, the runs and wickets and catches have to be in there. That is clearly a big part of what we do. But my personal interest in cricket goes sort of beyond what happens on the field of play. And I don't think we would survive, given the sort of the sort of all pervasive power of the internet now to generate stats every second, we wouldn't survive simply by being a statistical record. You know, we have to broaden our palette, and it's a challenge. I mean, God, there's so much to write about, isn't there? This discussion shows you can go off in so many directions, and you have to balance out the slight despair that we all feel about some of the directions cricket is taking with the joy of the game. I mean, that's the other thing. People buy Wisdom because they want to be uplifted. It's the start of the English season. It's a, you know, it's a great game, isn't it? And we do need to celebrate that as well as holding administrators to account. So I'll keep trying to get the balance as right as I can.
Just like to mention among the features, I love the Emma Johns feature on Jane Austen, and I loved her speculation that she might have taught round arm bowling to her nephew Edward Knight, who was a pioneer of it in the 1820s.
I think she allows the thought to sort of hang mischievously at the end of the piece. It's not, I don't think it's an outright claim, but it's nicely done by Emma.
It is.
It's a teasing thought, isn't it?
It is a teasing thought.
I got quite a sort of piece of news, really. We're going off air until the autumn. We have a podcast. Richard and I are going off to write a book, A History of Cricket. It's very unambitious. It deals with cricket since the beginning and in every country in the world. It's a wonderful task, by the way. And we are discovering all sorts of amazing things and being greatly educated by all the phenomenal people, the really learned people like Lawrence, who've been very kind to come on this program. So we're good, but we won't be back till the autumn.
Thank you very, very much, Lawrence, for giving us such a, yet again, another wonderful edition of Wisdom to talk about.
Thank you, Richard. Absolute pleasure to be here and to talk all about it. And hopefully, I'll see you in a year's time.
We hope so, too.
It's goodbye for me, Peter Oborne, from Nablus, where the sun's just come out.
It's goodbye for me, Richard Heller, in southeast London. The sun has come out, but I'm sure it's not having the same effect as it is in Nablus.